Good afternoon, Vice World Plaza, coming at you live from my house. It's Monday. It's 1 o'clock. It's book club time. We're starting a new book. And the book is Wisdom from the House of Healing by Rabbi Hanan Balk, the Rabbi Emeritus of Gulf Manor Synagogue. Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain. Let's get right to it. It's really, really, it's a great read. I've bounced around in the book here and there, and some of the stories are absolutely just terrific. The dialogue between patients and Rabbi Balk, it's wonderful stuff. So without further ado, the book just came out. It's very recently published this year, 2024. We're going to start from the beginning. Even the dedication page is worthy of our attention. Dedicated to Rita Balk, Rachel Bat Yisrael, beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. For 18 years, she courageously battled Parkinson's. Her zest for life and its endless gifts, not diminished, greeting each and every day with joy and a smile, excitedly awaiting the music that touched her soul. May her memory be for a blessing, the Balk family. Then comes the contents. We're going to focus today on the pages called To the Reader, the introduction, the song I sing, and then hopefully we'll get into, if we can, into Transformations. Chapter 1, Transformations, A New Journey Back to School. It's really quite, there's a lot here to chew. We're going to bite off a little bit and see what we can do. So let's get right to it. By the way, if you like the book, and you will, by the end of the reading of this book, Rabbi Balk informs me that it's on a sale. I think that Amazon is giving a discount, whereas normally it's about $27. He called me this morning and told me that it's available for $18 and change. So try to get your hands on a copy. And, of course, Rabbi Balk will be happy to inscribe it for you. He inscribed our copy and a very moving and beautiful inscription. We're very appreciative of that. To the reader, little A. As the title rabbi is used often throughout the work, the word will be abbreviated simply as capital R, period. For example, R, period, Joseph B. Soloveitchik. So the R will stand for the word rabbi. Little b, even with the many times the above term has been utilized, the author has significantly reduced its usage by delegating a large number of them to the footnote section. C, one who finds the footnotes cumbersome or distracting may read the work without them and not lose any major ideas. Little d, Hebrew names of personalities will retain their original spelling in the footnotes, but will be translated into English when such translations exist in the main body of the work. Thus, the name Yisrael will be maintained in the footnotes, but otherwise spelled Israel. Little e, this work is intended for readers of all backgrounds, of all religious faiths, and of no religious faith. Every person finds spiritual significance that speaks uniquely to his soul. That said, as the author is an adherent of the Jewish faith, his experiences and reflections overwhelmingly convey the wisdom he has garnered from that tradition. The truths of that tradition are sufficiently broad to inform and inspire others as they stand upon their own spiritual ground. Little F, we're on page 14 already. Parenthetical years of the lifespan of major personalities have been included the first time the name is mentioned in the main body of the work to provide context. This will not be done in the footnotes or for those who are alive. And finally, little g, many of the conversations between the author, that is to say, the chaplain, and the patient have been formatted in what is known as the verbatim exercise that those studying for the chaplaincy utilize to evaluate each other's visits. More about this in chapter one. It may be more familiar as the way one would read the dialogue between different characters in a play. For the sake of consistency, this style will generally be used whenever the author, that is, even when serving as rabbi and not as chaplain, even when the author is engaged in conversation with others. While this style may seem awkward at the outset, the reader should become comfortable with it as he proceeds through the book. Introduction, page 15. For over a quarter of a century, I was a successful congregational rabbi, a leader of the Jewish community who shaped and changed lives through sermons, speeches, classes, and hopefully set an example of living a life of integrity and holiness true to the teachings of a sacred heritage. I was honored locally, nationally, and by my colleagues across the country. I was a guest at the White House on three occasions. As I aged into my 50s and reflected upon the life of the rabbinate, which was both exhausting and very rewarding, I looked forward to the continuation of this life of devotion and service, an opportunity to put some of my thoughts into books and to spend more time with my wife, as well as our children and grandchildren, who were now all out of the house and out of town, living on their own. But this was not to be. In the words of an old Yiddish saying, and here I'll give you the Yiddish because I know it, man tracht und Gott lacht. Rabbi Balk gives it to you in English. Man plans, God laughs. It works in Yiddish because it rhymes in Yiddish. Man tracht, Gott lacht. Man plans, but God laughs. We often presume we are in control of our destiny, only to discover we are not. This was already foretold long ago. A rabbinic teaching concerning the opening words in the following verse in Genesis, chapter 37, verse 1. And Jacob dwelled in the land of the sojourning of his father, in the land of Canaan. The rabbinic teaching comments there, Rashi, that, quote, Jacob sought to settle down in peace. We can certainly understand Jacob's sentiment. After all, he had not had an easy life. He had endured a tremendous struggle with his brother Esau from a young age. He was forced to flee for his life from his homeland, tricked by his uncle Laban into working for 7 years to acquire his daughter Rachel in marriage, only to be given his older daughter Leah instead, then having to work 7 more years to acquire Rachel, and battled an unknown and mysterious foe in the valley of Yavok, surviving the encounter and consequently suffering a notable wound. After many difficult years, he now wished to quietly settle down with his many children and grandchildren, and if not retire, certainly take things a little easier, a bit more calmly than he had with what life had dealt him thus far. We are told in Jewish tradition that God was pondering the following thought at that very moment. Quote, is it not enough that the righteous will have everything set up for them in the next world, that they seek to settle down in peace in this world as well? End quote. The dream of settling down would never happen, for the furor regarding Joseph burst forth, says Rashi. So Rashi wrote all that. Is it not enough of the righteous? That was the Rashi thought. The message is clear. There is no rest for the weary in this world, even for those who are righteous and have lived extraordinary lives. As long as one can still achieve and accomplish, the work is never done. I do not in any way categorize myself as righteous, nor was I seeking to retire. But I guess the very thought of, quote, settling down a bit was sufficient to arouse explosive events of their own accord, ensuring that this was not going to happen. These events came in the form of a split in my congregation. The split eventually forced me, after a year and a half, to step down from my position and search for new employment. For many, many months, I mourned what had transpired, and to a great degree, continue grieving to this very day. It shattered my life, the life of my family, and the lives of many in the community. But life goes on, and one must summon the strength to move forward. Plenty of synagogues were looking for rabbis. I had to accept the fact that my days in Cincinnati were over and prepare myself to move on to the next community that God wanted me to serve and inspire for reasons he knew best. Confidently, I applied for scores of jobs, large ones and small ones. I was not contacted after the first application. The second or the third. I understood I had to be patient and faithful, that God would help me land the right position. Then the rejection notices began to come. I applied for well over 100 positions and was shocked to discover what perhaps should have been more obvious, as the Rabbinic Placement Service of Yeshiva University later confirmed, that my age had set me at a tremendous disadvantage. Yes, it seemed at age 52, congregations deemed a veteran rabbi as unusable. Though now I knew more than I ever had in terms of scholarship, relationships, and experience, my applications were repeatedly ignored, and the positions I sought were filled by rabbis almost half my age, new kids on the block, who had only served in previous positions for a few years, and whose salary expectations, consequently, were presumed to be far less. Okay, I got it. But what was going to become of me? As I continued the search for a job, I found myself in a period that William Bridges calls, quote, the neutral zone, a book, or that's the term anyway, the neutral zone. William Bridges wrote a book called Transitions. And in the book Transitions, he terms a phrase, the neutral zone. This is the time following a transition or crisis that provides the opportunity, should one embrace it, quote, to do the important business of self-transformation, inner reorientation, or to give meaning to, quote, the nothing, end quote, which has unexpectedly encompassed one's life. During this time, I kept reflecting upon the following words recited in the Jewish prayer service when the Torah scroll is removed from the Holy Ark. Quote, Ana avda dekutcha berichu. I'll give it to you in the Aramaic. Rabbi Balk gives it to us in the English. I am a servant of the Holy One, blessed be He. This is a remarkable statement, if there ever was one. I, a human being, am God's servant. I am here to help carry out God's work. This statement was a constant reminder to me amidst this very difficult episode of my life that because I was no longer in a leadership position as a congregational and community rabbi, did not mean that my role as God's servant had come to an end. I, and for that matter, all of us have a mission to fulfill. What kind of mission? It is a mission personalized for each one of us. What exactly the mission of each person is, that is where the confusion enters. It can be a tremendous struggle to make that discovery, and tragically, there are those who never make it. But God wants us to engage in that struggle. As Mark Twain so incisively stated, the two most important days in your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why. I like that. I came to the conclusion that either God had more than one mission for me, one mission had come to an end, while another was yet to begin, or my mission was going to be expanded to include elements I had not yet incorporated into it thus far. My wife suggested I consider a career change and train for hospital chaplaincy. I delayed, continuing to hope a rabbinic position would yet open somewhere, and I continued to resist her call for me to reinvent myself through this vocation. Finally, I heeded her advice and applied to several chaplaincy programs and was accepted at the Christ Hospital in Cincinnati. What is chaplaincy? What does a chaplain do? That is what this book is about, along with my experiences, reflections, and insights. Chaplaincy is a growing vocation. While the focus of this book is hospital chaplaincy, and specifically my work at the Christ Hospital, a 550-bed acute care hospital frequently noted nationally for its excellence in quality of care, chaplains may also serve in many other capacities, in nursing homes, police departments, the armed forces, prisons, corporations, even with sports teams. Much of what is presented herein with regard to the hospital setting will, for the most part, apply in varying degrees to other areas of chaplaincy as well. That said, in spite of the growth of chaplaincy, its existence in the eyes of the greater population seems not to be duly noted. Thus, I have still never seen a hospital chaplain at work on a television program, even when numerous programs feature hospitals as the central institution of the series. In other words, chaplains are still not viewed as essential to the hospital environment. A case in point, toward the end of the 2016 television season, and it was on November 17th, Grey's Anatomy, season 13, episode 9, presented a storyline of a collapsed building with scores of people injured or killed in the catastrophe. Among those who were being wheeled into the emergency room was a man, severely injured, begging to see a priest or a man of God. He announced he had a confession to make. His failing medical condition made his request urgent. I called for my wife to come and watch while screaming, "Hey, they're going to have a chaplain in this episode. Come and watch. Finally, they're going to feature a chaplain." As it happened, the only chaplain who was available at that time, a rabbi, was at the hospital's geriatric center and could not make it. So one of the medical staff told a colleague to serve as the priest, the man of God, and hear this patient's confession. While he did not want to do it, knowing that he had no experience or training in this area, his coworker would not let up, arguing that all he had to do was listen to a confession. Finally, he agreed to play the part. The patient confessed he was responsible for the building's collapse and the tragic loss of life because he did not get around to making the necessary changes that inspectors required of him to make the building safe. Immediately following his confession, he had a cardiac episode and a code was called to attempt to save his life. When others later asked the medical worker who had served as the priest to share with them what the man had confessed, he refused, arguing that since he had played the role of priest, he was bound by the rules of the confession and not permitted to disclose what was said. His colleagues did not accept his answer, knowing the entire scenario was not authentic in the first place, and pressured him to convey what he had learned. And so the only time I ever saw a show that promoted the need for a hospital chaplain, it ended up doing precisely the opposite, sending a message that if the chaplain is not available, any member of the medical staff can simply replace him. How hard could it be? Of course, a doctor or nurse can't be replaced by anyone who would be told to wing it. Specific and detailed skills are required in order to carry out such work. But what does a chaplain do that cannot be replicated by almost anyone? In truth, chaplains must be trained at what they do as much as medical staff. It is my hope that within these pages, a greater knowledge of how a chaplain must be trained, what he does, and how patients, staff, and family benefit from his presence and insights will be acquired, enabling the reader to appreciate the contributions of those who have dedicated themselves to this field. My encounters and subsequent reflections serve to illustrate more fully in practical, often humorous, and frequently very moving ways, this important vocation and how he who accepts its charge is called upon to address the suffering of others. It is also my fervent hope that a timely message from my experiences as a chaplain inspires the reader as well. For I submit that only in America is it possible for a rabbi wearing a skull cap to walk into a room to offer spiritual guidance to members of another faith and be consistently received and embraced with respect, openness, brotherhood, and joy. This suggests, I believe, that the crisis that currently plagues our country, before COVID-19 and racial brutality set in, divisiveness and suspicion exhibited by some toward anyone who subscribes to a view that substantially differs from their own can be defeated and overcome. That deep down, in a sharing of the spirit, common ground can be found to heal a fractured nation and make it whole once again. A final thought. As long as there is human suffering, the world will need chaplains. It would bring me the greatest satisfaction to know even one person has been sufficiently moved by the episodes herein to pursue this vocation as a career and seek to alleviate such suffering to the degree that God grants him that ability. But after all is said and done, can there be a greater goal for which anyone can strive in this world than the fulfillment of such a holy task as this? I have learned many transformative lessons from my experiences as a chaplain, but if I were to summarize the greatest lesson I gained from these encounters, of which you will be reading in the pages that follow, it would be encapsulated in the words of a magnificent poem composed by one of Judaism's greatest spiritual lights that follows this introduction. Its description of a growing expanse of the soul duly conveys my new sense of mission and direction that continues to inspire both my work and my life. Hanan Balk, Cincinnati, Ohio, 2024. On page 24, we're introduced to the poem. It's a poem by Rabbi Cook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Palestine. And the poem is called The Song I Sing. Of course, he wrote it in Hebrew. The translation is pretty good. And here it is. The song I sing. There is one who sings the song of the soul, and in his soul he finds all full spiritual satisfaction. And there is one who sings the song of the nation. He goes out of the circle of his individual soul, which he finds lacking breath. He aspires to mighty heights and cleaves to the totality of the congregation of Israel. He sings her song with her, shares in her suffering, delights in her hopes, contemplates her past and future, and investigates lovingly the inner content of her. And there is one whose soul broadens so that it extends beyond the border of Israel to sing the song of man. His spirit encompasses the totality of man and his majestic image. He aspires to mankind's collective destiny and longs for its perfection. From this living source, he draws his thoughts and quests his ambitions and visions. Abraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who lived 1865 to 1935. But here's the footnote, and you must hear it. This song, which is titled in English, The Song I Sing, in Hebrew is known as Shir HaMerubah, the four-leveled song. It appears, Rabbi Balk writes, in Orot HaKodesh, Volume 2, and that, of course, is one of the great works of Rabbi Cook, Orot HaKodesh, Lights of Holiness. The translation was offered to us from Bezalel Naor, and it appears in a book called When God Becomes History. And by the way, I have a copy of that book recently published, and I am toying with the idea of doing that book as a future book club book. But one book at a time, friends, one at a time. Says Rabbi Balk, the translation was from Bezalel Naor, which appears in, quote, When God Becomes History, though I have altered a few words. Rav Cook actually adds a fourth level as well, hence the name of the poem, the four-leveled song. He added a fourth level in the penultimate stanza, and then unites them all in the final stanza. And here it is. And there is one who broadens even beyond that, beyond the song of the soul, the song of the nation, the song of man. And there is one who broadens even beyond that until he unites with all of existence, with all creations, with all worlds, with all of them, utters song. And there is one who ascends with all these songs together in one bond. They all lift their voices and harmonize. The song of the soul, the song of the nation, the song of man, and the song of the world all combine in his midst constantly. End of song. The final verses, no doubt, are the expression of Rav Kook's own magnificent soul, striving for unity and harmony in all of creation. I am nowhere near that lofty level, but as I hope shall be shown in the course of this book, the stanzas to which I make reference are an accurate reflection of the strivings of my soul as it grew to encompass my devotion to personal spirituality, the Jewish people, and now, with the chaplaincy, a greater commitment to all of mankind. By the way, that's just beautiful. That is a magnificent, incredibly beautiful poem. I expect nothing less from Rav Kook. He was a universalist, okay, using Reformed terminology. He was not a particularist, even though he was that too. I mean, he was an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. So, of course, he loved and favored Klal Yisrael, obviously, over all of the nations. But at the same time, this poem proves positively that he begins to eclipse even that, right? He becomes a human being. He's part of mankind, not just a member of Klal Yisrael, but he's a lover of all humanity. And then he loves all the creation. And he joins in together with the animal world and the spiritual world and the universes and the galaxies and the planets. He's singing to God along with everything. And his soul is combined with it all. Wow. That's Rav Kook. Worthy of reading. We have to revisit him. Chapter 1. Transformations. Page 29. A New Journey. Here he quotes Rabbi Israel Salanter, founder of the Musar movement, who lived 1809 to 1883. The greatest distance in the world is the distance between the mind and the heart. Ponder that. Page 30. Back to school. Various hospitals offer what is known as clinical pastoral education. Henceforth, we'll call it CPE, for the training of chaplains, which originated in the mid-1920s. As evident in its name, this approach emphasizes the clinical method, which offers as its primary teaching action, reflection. This provides the means for a person to grow through actual experience, careful analysis of what went wrong and what went right, and then following up with an activity of the same nature to improve upon his initial effort. The program was created in response to a curriculum heavy on academic training in the classroom, with a study of theories detached from the patient and his needs, in order to stress that the lessons to be learned were primarily within the context of actual encounters with the patient. The primary founder of CPE, Anton Boizon, who lived 1876 to 1965, designated the patient as, quote, the living human document. This term conveyed the vital message that a human being, as much as any book or article, should be considered a major source from which the chaplain can learn. I found this idea to be very appealing because it is much in line with the Jewish approach that similarly values the human being as a teacher. Who is wise? Asks the rabbinical ethical work, Chapters of the Fathers, one who learns from every human being. Chapter 4, Mishnah 1, top page 31. In their exposure to the patient and his suffering, students of theology would thereby see matters in an entirely new light, not only in theoretical concepts of philosophy or the writings of religious thinkers, but also through the observed struggle of the human spirit with issues such as faith, hope, and compassion, along with the inner world of his emotional and spiritual life. The predicament and turmoil that challenges man in his time of travail, paradoxically, would enlighten the student of religion with the deepest sense of theology within an environment that was dynamic and alive, instead of the sterile, inauthentic, and disconnected venue of the lecture hall. It was further emphasized that through his experience with the patient, the student, the chaplain, would encounter these same issues in his own inner world, thus expanding his experience of self as well. Moreover, it requires the utilization of one's acquired religious training and tools in an effort to create an aura of sanctity and godliness in a room often darkened by the overbearing presence of illness and hopelessness. Among my first discoveries was this: age did not seem to be a major factor in becoming a chaplain. Indeed, there were a few members of my CPE program who were much older than I. Some of them had also served in a religious ministry of the church or school, and similarly lost their positions after lengthy and successful careers. Immediately, I felt I had companions who knew what I was going through and with whom I did not need to hide my sense of shame and sadness. Indeed, in discussing challenges we faced in our lives, I completely opened up about the very heavy feelings that concerned my fall from the rabbinate. It was absolutely the greatest therapy I could ever have had, bringing me comfort and hope as I expressed my battered emotions to a group who provided a sincere ear and uplifting words to help me on my way. To put it bluntly, I now had a new set of friends, friends for the first time in my adult life who were not Jewish, but more than that, friends who were spiritual leaders of other faiths, who were knowledgeable of biblical texts and themes, including, of course, the New Testament, and a few who had doctorates. We were fascinated with each other's backgrounds, and as I was in the minority, the ministers were especially fascinated with the fact that a rabbi was in their midst. While we all called each other by our first names, many preferred to call me the rabbi as a sign of respect. This was just one of many surprises I would discover as I started my training for the chaplaincy. Section, Making a Rabbi into a Chaplain, page 33. Though I had visited patients in hospitals for decades, praying for them, discussing theological matters with them, and caring for their families as well, there were important differences that distinguished the visit of a clergy member from that of a chaplain. Number one, self-reflection. The idea of self-reflection, which you may have seen on page 31, to be sensitive to my own strengths, weaknesses, and points of vulnerability as an important component in making me a better chaplain, was strange. When did a clergy member ever focus upon his own emotions and inner world in an attempt to better himself when visiting the sick? That seems so egotistical. Shouldn't my complete known concern be the patient's? This insight, however, is extremely important. It is not unusual for a chaplain to encounter a patient who has an illness that, for example, the chaplain's own mother may have had before she passed, or who was suffering in the same way the chaplain saw his best friend suffer. This may lead to the chaplain reflecting upon his own similar experience, which is fine and expected, but he must nevertheless maintain control of his emotions amidst that difficult visit so as to differentiate between his own needs and those of the patient. If he should become so drawn into the suffering of the patient that he begins to re-experience his own pain, reacting and responding to it instead of that of the person before him, his ability to work with the patient may be compromised. Through the use of an exercise known as verbatim, wherein a student documents a visit word for word in dialogue form with an analysis of, among other elements, the chaplain's emotional state during the visit, one's peers can offer meaningful suggestions to aid him in becoming more self-aware and self-reflective. After all, if one does not know himself well, how is it possible for him to know others? If one is not in touch with his own feelings, how can he possibly get a complete understanding of the feelings of those who he is charged to serve? Number two, familiarity. When a leader of a congregation visits the hospital, he is generally visiting his own congregants with whom he may already have a meaningful relationship, making the experience much more comfortable for all parties. In such a case, the clergy member has no need to get to know the person or to establish his religious authority. He also shares the same faith as the patient, with certain doctrinal, ritual, and cultural elements already defined and understood. The chaplain rarely knows the patient or family when he enters the room. He must first, quote, break the ice and establish a measure of trust so the patient is willing to share his deepest feelings with him. This happens in the way the chaplain presents himself in the challenging atmosphere of suffering and illness through both his verbal language and body language. As is almost always the case for me, his religion may differ from the patient's, which may require the need to overcome some cultural obstacles and affirm his spiritual prowess is broad enough to encompass the spiritual elements of all those who suffer. Further, the clergy member may visit the patient numerous times, call him on the phone, stay in touch with his family outside of the hospital, contact others to pray for their fellow congregational member, list him in the congregational newsletter, announce his name from the pulpit, and should the patient ask for it, appeal for congregants to visit him. A chaplain, on the other hand, must maintain the privacy of the patient, both legally, known as HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and morally. Unless specifically requested, he is not permitted to bring the patient and his condition to the awareness of others. And finally, in all likelihood, the chaplain may never see that patient again after his visit. While this may not be the case for all chaplains, it is often the case at the Christ Hospital, an acute care hospital, which does not focus on patients who are in need of long-term care, nor is the chaplain expected to stay in touch with the patients after he has seen them, not in the hospital, and certainly not outside of the hospital. I confess that I initially could not understand this approach. Would it not show more sensitivity, I pondered, for me to stay in touch with patients and their families, to continue to call them, check up on how they're doing? It now makes much more sense to me. Top page 36. While a clergy member has a finite amount of patients to visit and engages in a variety of other activities during his workday, the patient load of the chaplain, whose entire day is focused on visiting patients, is often overwhelming. Practically speaking, it would be impossible for a chaplain to stay connected to each patient after his visit. Moreover, the consideration of a chaplain's own emotional state after being immersed in the lives of so many who are suffering is also of concern. How could he possibly bear the burden of an ongoing line of communication with the suffering of hundreds of different patients that every new week brings to his care? Three, the role of the emotions. In the congregational visit, the conversation held with the patient may be guided by the clergy member and may be deemed successful if the patient and family are happy he came to support them. For the chaplain, however, the emotions of the patient are of major concern, aside from just a pleasant visit. The chaplain seeks to uncover those emotions, identify them, and allow the patient to express them fully, to release a heavy burden he may have not as yet shared, with even those with whom he is closest. To me, this represented a tremendous challenge. It required a journey from the more mind-centered ministry of a rabbi, where study, preaching, writing, and answering questions about issues of Jewish law had been the centerpiece of my occupation, to a ministry that was much more concerned with the heart and the emotions. This required a transformation of sorts on my part, which the curriculum of CPE would help to foster. My friends, This chapter is a very, very long one. We're on page 36, and it empties out way, way from here on page 47. Here. Let's see. We still have some time. Let's do it. On page 36, let's see if we can do 10 pages. I remember one occurrence within our CPE class when, in discussing past struggles in our lives, one of the students began to cry. A friend of hers stood up, walked over to her chair, and attempted to hug her. Our supervisor immediately intervened. Sit down and do not touch her. You can give her a tissue, but do not touch her. We want her to be able to cry so she will fully express her emotions. If you hug her, it may lead her to close up. Just let her cry. This sounds rather cruel upon first reading, but now I understand the point. I believe we greatly underestimate the power of tears and fail to appreciate the channel it creates for a person to express his deepest and most precious feelings. Many members of the clergy, and I include myself as the primary example, are trained in a more cerebral fashion, listening to what the patient says instead of understanding what he means and seeking a solution to his problems as a quick fix. Indeed, I would initially attempt to, quote, solve the problems of the patient, not understanding that in many, if not most cases, those problems cannot be solved. And even the patient himself is fully aware of this truth. Every time I would present a verbatim that presented my response to the patient in the mode of a fixer, my CPE supervisor would comment, "You are being too much of a Talmudic rabbi. You are not in that room to solve that patient's problems. Stop utilizing your mind so much. Let your heart do the connecting and focus on the patient's emotions." I knew my supervisor enjoyed the lessons of Jewish sacred texts and meant no disrespect for the Talmud or rabbinic scholarship whatsoever. What she was trying to get across to me was that this situation did not call for me to utilize Talmudic logic and intervene with some type of brilliant solution. In the words of James Didis, who lived 1926 to 2009, whose words concerning the pastoral counselor are of equal importance to the chaplain, quote, "He does not try to do anything and is not struggling to make something happen, to make repairs or to make changes. He does not condemn, approve, diagnose, explain. He," meaning the chaplain or the pastoral counselor, "he does not save, but witnesses the saving steadfastly, undistracted, relentlessly." See, James Didis in his work, Ascetic Witness, in Robert Dykstra's book, Images of Pastoral Care. Didis continues to make his point, adding that it is not his goal to have, quote, "to have an impact, to make a difference, or to leave his or her mark, to solve problems, to master perplexities, to understand and know and explain why things are the way they are," end quote. It's not the job of the chaplain to do all that, says Rabbi Balk. Rather than be so focused upon taking action to cure the patient's spiritual maladies, the chaplain must instead engage in what Carrie Jackson has called soul listening. You'll find that in the book, The Gift to Listen, The Courage to Hear. Soul listening is an approach that recognizes that a patient does not look to you so he can be fixed. Rather, he seeks simply to be heard and understood. Hearing the patient's words, however, is not just a passive event as practiced by the chaplain, but as described by Douglas Steer, 1901 to 1995, as described by Steer, it means to listen another soul into life, into a condition of disclosure and discovery, end quote. Writes Rabbi Balk, this act of, quote, holy listening, as Douglas Steer calls it, quote, "may be almost the greatest service that any human being performs for another," end quote. Indeed, when done properly, such an act gives the one who suffers a voice previously muted by the pain he had experienced. And here Rabbi Ball gives us a story. A great rabbi was once seated in the study hall, preparing for the arrival of Shabbos by studying the Bible's book Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, understood in Jewish tradition to be a metaphor of the intense love between God and the Jewish people and between God and each human being. Of course, he also gives a footnote. See Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, Laws of Repentance, who suggests this metaphor instead of the more well-known one of the love of God and the Jewish people. As the rabbi further immersed himself in the spiritual masterpiece, known in the Talmud as the Holy of Holies, due to its special sanctity, a Jewish cowherd burst into the hall, and with him a barnyard stench. "Rabbi!" the man said. "My cow! My cow!" The rabbi lifted his eyes from the holy words upon which he had been meditating and asked the man, "What is wrong with your cow?" The man explained that the cow was having great difficulty giving birth, and were the cow to die, he would lose his entire livelihood. The rabbi calmed the man down, connected him to a veterinarian, and then offered a prayer that his cow should give birth in good health. Another rabbi who observed what had happened approached his colleague in dismay. "How could you interrupt from your high spiritual level for a cow?" The rabbi responded, "Didn't you hear that man crying?" His colleague answered, "Yes, I heard him crying, my cow, my cow." "You did not listen well," he replied. The simple person was really saying, "Rabbi, draw me close to you." But as a very simple person, he had no context in which to say that, except through conveying his everyday mundane needs. Find that in Eliashiv Reichler's book, By Faith Alone. This story concerning Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin and his colleague Rabbi Yisrael of Apter was told by Rabbi Yehuda Amital. How poignant is this story? Chaplains, caregivers, and all human beings bear a great responsibility to listen to what the patient and anyone who is in pain is saying. There are times when a person is truly seeking spirituality, but we may miss the deeper signs and fail him by stopping at the surface. A similar lesson can be found in this story. Following the Holocaust, a teen who had lost his entire family no longer would have anything to do with Judaism. He was finally brought to a great rabbi, but feared that once again, a conversation would ensue about the topics of faith and belief, topics that, for him, were no longer meaningful after Auschwitz. But the rabbi mentioned nothing of these topics. He just softly told the boy that he could see that he was angry. The boy burst out, "Of course I am angry. The best were taken away. The finest are lost forever." "You are so right," the rabbi replied. "They left me, and they took away my wife and 11 children." He then began to sob, and the boy began to sob. They embraced each other. No more words were spoken. No more words were spoken, for no more words had to be spoken. For no more words. The boy left the rabbi's home after an hour. He prayed that night, and within a few months, began to take on Jewish observances again. The boy, now in his 70s, later recalled, "There was nothing that anyone could say to me, and the rabbi understood that. Everyone spoke to my head. The rabbi touched my heart." Found in Rabbi Pesach Kron's Echoes of the Maggid, the rabbi in the story was the Klausenberger Rebbe, the Kusil Yehuda Halberstam. There are times when a person has been so wounded from tragedy that he is not looking for conversation, just being present. And in this case, sharing your tears to show you are genuinely concerned with someone's plight is an incredible example of how to connect and provide comfort for one in need. Footnote, this concept is illustrated in Jewish law. When one visits a mourner at his home during the seven-day mourning period, the Shiva period, in order to comfort him, he's not permitted to initiate the conversation, but must wait for the mourner to do so. It is entirely possible that the mourner is not interested in the conversation amidst his grief, that the comfort is given just by the person's presence at the mourner's time of need and not through his words. This also alleviates the discomfort of the visitor, who often does not know what to say to the mourner, for he is not required to say anything. And in many tragic situations, there is, in fact, nothing that can be said. This idea, which Judaism offered thousands of years ago, later became known in the field of chaplaincy as a, quote, ministry of presence. For a long time, says Rohrbach, I could not properly appreciate the importance of creating a setting that allowed for the emotions of the person with whom I was working to emerge until the following situation occurred. I had gone to visit a woman upon the passing of her husband. She had asked for a chaplain to recite prayers for the deceased. When I entered the room, she was not there. Only the deceased was, which was unusual. After the nurse had found her and brought her to the room, she remarked that she did not know if she wanted to go back into the room, for the person who was lying there no longer looked like her husband. I told her that was fine. But she then changed her mind and invited me in with her to offer prayer. Following the prayer, she asked to speak with me in a room down the hall. She explained to me that her husband had suffered from MS, multiple sclerosis, for the past 23 years, since he was age 35. He had been bedridden throughout that time, so their two young children hardly knew they had a father, as he could not participate in many of the events of their lives. Oh, my God. I didn't read this far in preparation, and this is killing me. I'll continue. The wife commented that for those 23 years, she had been caring for her husband day in and day out, that he had cheated death many times, especially when 8 years before he had been comatose and nobody expected him to survive. She said she felt numb. What was she to do now with her life after her role as caregiver was finished? Her husband was always there, and she could not believe he had actually passed away. Just then, a nurse and staff manager had come over to hug her and wish her well. They had known the patient and his wife for decades. One of them told her, "Be strong." The other said, "You know he is now in a better place." Indeed, the wife responded that she was so happy now for her husband, because, quote, it was like he was imprisoned in his body, and now he was free. Top page 43. During this entire conversation, I noticed she had hardly shed a tear. She then asked me, "What do you tell a person in my situation?" Now, to many, I add myself to that list, prior to being trained as a chaplain, it would appear this woman was handling everything quite well, and her perspective was right on the mark. But I challenged that scenario and told her this, quote, "Everyone is telling you to be strong, and I am sure they are very well intended. But you have been strong for the past 23 years. You no longer have to be strong. You can cry. You can grieve for your loss. Moreover, doing so is not in any way a sign of weakness." End quote. Immediately, this woman began to cry for the first time since I had arrived an hour prior. In fact, after she had shed those tears, she has to go back into the room again to see her husband, to face the reality that was before her and gaze upon what she had lost. This was an example of the insight I had gained into the emotional realm of which my mentor had attempted so often to make me aware of in my interaction with others. Incidentally, the idea of, quote, active listening would clearly work wonders beyond the realm of the chaplain and the patient. I have no doubt, for example, that such efforts on the part of spouses would contribute to the health of a marriage, both in terms of its quality and its longevity. Little B. Much of the relationship a clergy member develops is reflected in a public setting, in front of hundreds of people, through sermons, from the pulpit, or classes. The chaplain is generally, in his daily duties, focused upon the individual patient, or staff, or family member. Top page 44. Mother Teresa, who lived in the 20th century, the great humanitarian who devoted her life to caring for the poor, the sick, and the dying, once said, quote, "One never cares for a crowd, only for a person. If I visualize the crowd, I would never get started. The important thing is the individual," end quote. While I questioned the truth of this quote initially, I now believe it to be correct. When, for example, a newspaper or a TV ad wants to arouse an emotional response in the reader or the viewer. The focus is usually a close-up of one child whose face and circumstances are overwhelming. The same effect may not necessarily occur if the focus is on a larger group. The chaplain has the opportunity, in a more intimate setting, to focus fully on the patient and his emotional state without concern for the crowd. Number four, difference again between a clergyman and a chaplain, staying in the moment. The moment of which we are speaking must be one in which the chaplain gives his full attention to the patient with no distractions and with no indication he is in a hurry to see other patients. There is no greater purpose than to minister to the individual who is before him in the here and now. At the end of my day, there are almost always patients who have not been seen by me. Often they were unavailable or resting or away from their rooms for tests. That is not a major problem. Other members of the chaplaincy team will take over and complete the work I was unable to finish. I give each the time he needs for his visit. This luxury may not exist with a clergy member of the hospitalized congregant. He needs to see this patient, and he may have others to see at other hospitals as well, with no one else to whom he can pass them off, unless he has an assistant. He must make the time for this to happen. Should a patient be unavailable, he must try again at some point and cannot simply move on, knowing a colleague will follow up. And finally, the last difference between a rabbi and a chaplain, coming with an agenda. Number five, coming with an agenda. It is impossible for a clergy member to visit a patient with a specific agenda. I'm sorry. I am so sorry. Did I read that? It is possible. It is, yes, indeed. It is possible for a clergy member to visit a patient with a specific agenda. For example, a patient who excitedly claims to have recently found Jesus as his personal savior and would like the chaplain to speak to him about the next steps in his journey would do better to seek out a member of the clergy instead, who can connect the patient to others who can help shepherd him, recommend classes he can take, and even suggest he attend a particular church that may suit his needs. A chaplain should not be driven by a religious agenda to promote a certain faith. With the exception of a priest, minister, rabbi, or imam who is specifically hired to serve the patients of that faith, to promote a certain faith would not be appropriate. Indeed, to be true to the patient and to his own role and sense of duty, it may be the chaplain's job to challenge the patient's newfound belief, even if the chaplain is Christian and happily welcomes the patient's newfound discovery of the role of Jesus in his life, to see if this is an appropriate decision the patient has made, or if it is a way to somehow mask his true emotions and the hard work needed to confront them by simply leaping into a world of perceived salvation. Later in the book, I detail a visit I had with an 80-year-old man who had decided, after heart surgery had failed, he was not going to continue on his heart pump machine, but have it removed so he could expire. I ministered to the patient and his family at the place they were, without commenting upon that decision. If I would have been acting as a rabbi and not a chaplain, let us say for a member of my congregation who considered me his authority for matters of Jewish law, I have no doubt I would have engaged him in a conversation, raising various issues as they relate to the pain he was experiencing or might experience, and the general idea of pulling the plug, thereby ensuring he fully understood what Jewish tradition had to say about the moral issues of the situation before proceeding. These distinctions between the visit of a member of the clergy and a chaplain are an indication, as you mentioned in the introduction, that not everyone can simply assume the role of a chaplain in a hospital or in any other organization. To be sure, while a member of the clergy may have a strong religious background and knowledge of biblical texts and liturgy that are essential for him to serve as a resource to the patient, like any other vocation, a chaplain must be educated in accordance with the requirements and standards of his profession. I in no way intend to belittle the role that spiritual leaders occupy in the lives of their congregants when they are hospitalized. I served in that role for 28 years, but now that I have studied CPE, I see clearly, and I have never known for a fellow clergyman to disagree, that if I would have had access to such education as part of my rabbinic training, I would have been a better caregiver for my congregation. Such training helped me to be more attentive to both the individual and to myself. And we end, top 47. It took the hospital environment with all of its multifarious components to enlighten me and provide me with fresh opportunities to serve God and my fellow man through the spiritual gifts with which I had been blessed. Let us now examine the nature of the hospital so as to better understand and appreciate the wondrous and yes, yes indeed, sacred place that this institution truly is. And we've completed chapter one. My dear friends, I want to thank you very much for staying with me a little bit overboard. Hopefully you enjoyed. I wish everybody a great day. I'm hoping you enjoyed Wisdom from the House of Healing as we kick off this beautiful book by our esteemed Rabbi Emeritus of Gulf Manor Synagogue, Rabbi Hanan Balk, who's writing beautifully, as he always does, in every sermon he ever gave, was always pure poetry, a piece of art that he would give that I would look forward to. Beautifully delivered, well thought out, well conceived, just an absolute piece of art, always, 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 every Shabbos. Be a member of the Gulf Manor Synagogue was to know you were going to get a beautiful drusha every morning by Rabbi Balk. I wish everybody a great day, a wonderful day, a day of spiritual healing if you need it. Please come back next week for more wisdom from the House of Healing, transformative encounters of a hospital chaplain, the Rabbi Balk. Wishing everybody a great one. Don't forget tomorrow night, Tanakh Tuesday, we continue with our study of Isaiah. All the best, everybody. Tzai Gesund. See you tomorrow night. Bye-bye now.